Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and reading with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
Today I'll be talking to two different animal lovers who wrote the stories of canine members of their families. Later in the hour, Orland author and illustrator Jane King tells the story of Frisky the Fox, which can delight both children and adults. Her memoir, A Fox in the Family, contains pencil sketches by the author and family photographs. My first guest had a career in public education before moving to Shasta County. Bob Magic's last book was The Sacramento, A Transcendent River. His newest book recounts the journey of a rescue dog from an animal shelter to being adopted by the author and his wife. Ebbett's Pass, Ebby for short, was a dog who became a canine good citizen, a therapy dog, a service dog, and a performer in live theater. And the book is Ebby's Tale. Bob Magic, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, I thought as I start, I see the cover and I see this is Ebbett's Tale, T-A-L-E. Of course, that's a pun because dogs have tails and they wag them. But I didn't know about the name Ebby until I read that it was short for Ebbett's Pass. And I thought, gosh, that's a strange name for a dog. And then I remembered some people who had a cat they named Yazoo City, Mississippi. Oh. I thought, oh, people sometimes name their pets after places.
Well, we have a history of naming our pets after places in the Central Sierra where we had a cabin. And the cabin was on Ebbett's Pass. But we had a dog named Reba. We had a cat named Murphy's for the town of Murphy's, another one called Sierra. So that's our history. But the principal reason for that particular name was Deanne wanted it to be the only dog so named for the American Kennel Club designation. So we felt Ebbett's Pass was a sure thing, and it just became Ebby for short.
Well, you might say, could you just mention the name of your wife? Why don't you identify your wife? Yeah,
my wife, Deanne. It's Diane, but with a French pronunciation.
And she plays a big role in this story, of course.
She sure does.
So when you acquire this dog, and it was Ebby was a rescue dog.
Correct.
And it didn't come with that name. You say you named it, but this dog was already had a name when you got her.
Her name was Gypsy, and we saw her picture in the paper when we were in the process of looking for a new pet. Our last pet lasted 18 years. Miko died, and then we went 4 years without a pet. And then it was time to get a new one so that we were looking for dogs that show up in the Record Search Light and in their advertisement for rescue dogs. We tried out a couple. And I recount one or two of those experiences in the book. And then we saw this picture of a dog named Gypsy, and her behaviors and her description just seemed perfect. So we arranged for her foster parent, Susan Marshall, out of Raining Cats and Dogs, to bring Ebby to our home for a look-see.
But she wasn't bringing Ebby. She was bringing Gypsy.
Excuse me. Correct. You're good for you. She's long since become Ebby in our minds. But in any case, she brought Gypsy.
And you might explain why Susan called her Gypsy.
Well, she went to the Tehama County Animal Shelter and saw three dogs. She normally just takes one to foster, but all three looked adoptable. They were all small dogs, and Gypsy was one of them. Of course, it wasn't Gypsy when she went there. But she named her Gypsy because of her past, which included running down Antelope Boulevard as a scot-free stray. And because of this past of hers, where she was footloose and fancy free, she named her Gypsy. And the other dogs also had their own little names. So she rescued all three and then proceeded to foster all three. The other two, interestingly, got adopted much sooner than Gypsy did because Gypsy had some issues.
Well, there's so much in your book that reflects my experiences and my dog history. And a friend of mine, just recently, I met her new little rescue dog. And when I met that dog, I thought, how in the world could anybody give up, abandon, whatever the story was, give up a little dog this adorable? It's just the perfect little dog for her. And you raised that same question. How could anybody give up a dog like Gypsy? How did she get loose? She was running down the road. How did anybody let that happen?
Well, the blank spot in our knowledge of Gypsy and our history with her is her puppyhood and her first year. We know zero about that other than she was a stray, and it's very clear she was not socialized to interact with humans whatsoever. Although, ironically, she was very friendly when Susan went and saw her in the cage. This particular animal was happy to see her, tail wagging, and so forth. And she decided to foster her. So, but before that, Gypsy's first year is just a blank.
Well, you know, there's so many things in your book that I think, boy, that's my history too. For example, my husband and I had dachshunds, and we had one at first. Well, we didn't want the next ones to be by themselves. So we got two. They grew old and died. And my husband said, okay, now we won't get any more dogs. We're free to travel. And I was like your wife, oh, but I miss those dogs. And so you resisted getting another dog.
For quite a few years, yeah, four in fact. Because, again, the travel freed us up from, like I mentioned, those endless knocks on lodges and motel rooms. Do you take pets?
That's
and
right.
Most of them do not. So that it did give us much more leeway in traveling. And we were, at that point, traveling a lot overseas. But at some point, she needed a dog.
Yeah. Well, you lasted longer than my husband did. I wore him down, his resistance, and we got two more little dogs. And you also say that you resisted wimpy dogs. Now, Bob.
Well, there are a number of cute little dogs that are white usually and that are cute. And for personal description, I suppose, I would label some of them wimpy. So that that was a dog I would tend to resist. Too cute for their own good. Maybe curly-haired.
Well, there's something else I saw in your book that I had heard from one source. And this was a woman that raised dachshunds, and she told us that dachshunds couldn't swim. I didn't protest, but I thought, well, our dachshunds can swim. So I noticed that line in your book where dachshunds usually can't swim.
Right, right. Well, this foster parent was just being particularly concerned about where this dog was going to find a home. And you're talking about Scrappy, this little long-haired dachshund that we checked out. And, you know, these foster parents of dogs just do a marvelous job. And their main priority is the dog. So that was her concern. I mean, we kind of glossed over it. Oh, we certainly weren't going to build a fence around our swimming pool. But we said, like I mentioned in the book, well, we'll do something.
Because they're pretty stringent. Their requirements. And you got vetted. She calls the veterinarian and said, are these people worthy of adopting a dog?
Yeah.
And so she checks out past history, and the veterinarian says, oh, yeah, great possible adoptive parents, if you want to use that word.
Right. Yeah, that also applied to one of the first couples that were going to adopt Gypsy.
My guest is Bob Magic, and his previous book was about the Sacramento River. But his recent book, his new book, is about a rescue dog that went from shelter to stage. So I won't be giving anything away because it's on your cover that this little dog that started her life as when you met her as Gypsy and became Ebby, and she ends up on the stage. Now, oddly enough, Bob, that's my history too. I had a little singing dog who could sing on cue and was the star of the show.
Really?
Yes, because, and I could tell the moment the audience saw the little dog, because you would hear this collective, oh.
Now, what show are you talking about?
This
stage?
Was not here in Chico.
Uh-huh.
And this was Sugar Babies.
Oh.
And there was when we were having the rehearsal, and the director asked one of the early rehearsals, we were working on the music, and he said, well, how are things going? And I said, well, I'm really not the singer in my family. The real singer is my dog. And he said, oh, really? He said, come have the dog audition. So, and Oscar sang right on cue. And then later, when a TV station showed some clips from our show, we got, you know, I'm dancing, tap dancing my toes off. We got maybe a couple of seconds, and Oscar got the full time. Because there he would throw his head back and sing. And
Well, dogs are such lovable creatures.
Oh, aren't they?
Yeah.
Aren't they? Well, now, I mentioned the audition for Oscar, since all he had to do was just sing on cue. But now, Ebby's audition was rather complete, rather thorough.
Well, it was rather complete and thorough, but interestingly, they being the director and producer of the show that she was auditioning for, The Wizard of Oz, didn't have her do any behaviors that turned out to be the critical behaviors for her performance. So,
and you were worried.
I was very worried, yeah. So they kind of overlooked what actually would be called for. And what was called for was pretty daunting for a dog.
Well, how did they go about auditioning? Because, like I say, Oscar only had to sing. But Ebby had a lot of different activities she had to perform in the role of Toto in Wizard of
yes,
the Oz.
Yes.
And you might mention where this was taking place.
Well, this was at the Cascade Theater 2 years ago this past spring.
In Reading.
In Reading, correct. And this is a renovated theater, and it's just a majestic theater at this point. I mean, just being there is a privilege. And the outside marquee is sparkling at night, really quite inspiring.
Well, how many people does it hold? How many people can...
Approximately 950. And every show is packed.
Yeah, because you say that 10,000 people saw... And there are only 12 performances.
Correct. Yeah.
And 10,000 people saw these performances.
All right.
And were just blown away by the
yes.
quality of the performers and the whole show.
Well, the Cascade has a history now of putting on those quality performances. We did Mary Poppins a year ago, and just this past year, I'm forgetting what they just got through doing. But in any case, they're doing The Rock of Ages this week is opening night, and we plan to go Thursday night.
My guest is Bob Magic. He lives in Anderson, and his dog is Star of the Stage in Reading at the Cascade Theater. And the title of his book is Ebby's Tale, From Shelter to Stage. So we've kind of skipped over the part that what Ebby had to, starting as Gypsy, had to go through to get to this point where you could say, I think maybe we'll let her audition for... Apparently they put out a casting call that they were looking for dogs to be
right.
in this production of The Wizard of Oz. So did you jump right on it? Or?
Well, my wife did. Uh-huh. She came home, but her eyes were just aglow saying, they want auditions for Toto. And I kind of was a little bit more skeptical about that, knowing that, my God, a live stage, what is that going to entail? But it was interesting enough that we brought Ebby up for her audition. And she just passed with flying colors because, first of all, she looks like Toto.
Yes.
And she's very spirited and does all kinds of tricks. She's very food motivated. If there's one characteristic of Ebby, she's food motivated. So she just wowed them with her little performance of tricks. And they also had her be stationary while a loud noise just boomed through the theater. And Ebby didn't budge an inch, which is characteristic of her personality, her temperament. And then they had a little boy just running by, stomping as close as could be. And again, Ebby didn't budge. She has that kind of temperament, which boded very well for her performance as Toto. Now, she had three behaviors. You mentioned that I lost a little bit of sleep. I was very worried about these behaviors. And one of which was being held for extended periods of time and passed around from person to person, person to person. Now, just based on our last dog, he couldn't be held for more than 10 or 20 seconds by either Deanne or me. I mean, we're the owners, and yet he refused to be held. And I think it's rare for a dog to be comfortable being held for extended periods of time. It's the case, and I learned this recently, but no dog likes to be hugged. If you hug them, and if you hug Ebby, it seems like she's enjoying it. She's licking your face, but she's actually exhibiting a lot of anxiety. So no dog likes to be hugged. So that was one very concern. And then just being led around the stage on a leash. I mean, she was never free. She was either on a leash or being held. And a dog will occasionally dig in and not budge, and Ebby has been known to do that. So that was a second concern. And then the third concern was all these scary people, the monkey and the lion, and, you know, in their costumes. How would Ebby relate? So that those behaviors in front of a 1,000 people, live audience on stage, really got me concerned, which were heightened when, first of all, Ebby didn't like to be on stage. And when she was first on stage, she was quite anxious and, you know, didn't enjoy it. There's nothing enjoyable about being held, being picked up, being ridden around on a bicycle. I mean, it's not something a dog would ordinarily move toward. So one of the rehearsals shortly after her beginning practices, beginning rehearsals, she saw Dorothy coming, Jenna Placina Laird, who played Dorothy, and just, you know, broke from her, wanting to get into our protective presence. And I thought, oh, my God, nothing could be worse. Here's Toto of trying to avoid Dorothy. But as I mentioned, Jenna just took the responsibility of bonding with Ebby. And from then on, it was just smooth sailing. And Ebby is not a wimp by any means, and she certainly isn't just completely and totally laid back. But she does have a very compliant, calm temperament. You can give a test to a new dog. Now, you can throw a dog sitting there, it's like in the middle of a room, throw a blanket over it. Some dogs will just panic, struggle, try to get out. Other dogs that have more placid temperament will just stay there. Ebby will probably take a nap under that blanket until we come back and take the blanket off of her. So much to my surprise, Ebby just lapsed into that role, and people passed her around as though I mentioned her being just an inert beanbag. And we solved the problem of her balking on a leash through some strategies. So it turned out she just was almost perfect, almost perfect.
My guest is Bob Magic, and he's written the story of a dog that is turns out to be very talented on stage. The dog's name is Ebby. So the book is Ebby's Tale, From Shelter to Stage. Another thing you mentioned that I was kind of surprised about, our dachshunds used to like to ride in a bicycle basket because they knew it meant a trip to the park or something fun. But people would ask, you mean you can get those dogs to stay in the basket? Don't they want to jump out? Well, no, because they had ridden in a basket since they were tiny puppies. But now Ebby was not used to riding in a basket, and yet she was content to do that on stage.
Here again, it was surprising. She balked at nothing, absolutely nothing, including being put in the basket, and the Wicked Witch would ride off the stage with Ebby in the basket. And Ebby knew I was right off in the wings waiting for her, but she just took it like it was just business as usual. Totally surprising. And Ebby is not, you know, totally docile on all occasions. She has a point of view. She has a little bit
of stubbornness. You call her
a bully. She is. She's actually a bully on some occasions. But her willingness to just be totally, totally compliant throughout that production was quite gratifying to see, quite gratifying to see.
Well, you mentioned that obviously these are live performances. Unlike the Toto in the movie, the director can keep taking take after another till they get the dog to do just what they want to do, and then they're done, and the dog doesn't have to do any more. But your dog has to be on cue, on her mark
for all 12 performances.
Every performance.
Yeah.
Annie, the production Annie, has a dog in it, and I was in a production of Annie, and the young girl that played Annie was just so talented, and the dog was a rescue dog. And every performance, that dog was just right on cue, except one evening. And the dog decided he would just walk off stage. And the young girl was flustered a little bit. She recovered. But so I was thinking, well, Ebby, every night she hit her mark, every night, never did anything wrong.
Well, there was one blooper. And I described that in the book, because normally she would be on a leash or being held. And in this one scene, Dorothy hooked the leash to a hook that we had there on one of the props. Well, the hook got free, and Ebby found that she could move. And her first objective at that point is to get off the stage. I told you that being on stage, being held, being passed around, bicycle, these are not enjoyable experiences that she would seek out.
So she might not enjoy it, but what about the audience?
So when she got off and started walking to the wings and got shooed from there by some people, frightened her, she went running back to Dorothy. Dorothy just nonchalantly put her back on the hook. Abby started barking. First time only she barked in a performance. So Jenna went over, Dorothy went over in the middle of her singing and dancing, took Abby to be there while she was singing and dancing. Abby continued to bark. Totally aberrant behavior. At this point, she was totally rogue, going rogue. So Dorothy just casually walked over to the stage left and said, "Okay, Toto, you go first," and just banished her from the stage. And the audience broke up and absolutely loved it.
Well, I was impressed then with the actress that she's in the middle of singing and dancing. The dog is not doing, Abby's not doing what she's supposed to be doing. And she can just, it sounded like she just very smoothly went over and collected the dog and just kept on with the performance and smoothed things out. And well, yet the audience still knew, oh, no, the dog's not supposed to be doing it.
They knew it was a blooper. They knew. And many people later, when we asked them if they saw Toto, those that were there that night said, "Oh, we were there when the dog got free." But Jenna Pacina Laird is just a pro. She just is outstanding.
Yeah, that's what it sounded like. Yeah. And she was also the producer.
Producer of that show. Yeah.
So Abby does such a fantastic job in that production that I would think you'd say, well, let's have her do another show. But that wasn't exactly.
That's easy enough to say because we probably invested more than 1,000 hours, Dan and I, being there all the time, rehearsals and so forth and so on. So it really is a physical grind, but much more so for the actors that are in these shows. I mean, they just invest so much. It's such a dedicated group. But you're right. Another phone call came saying that they had a part in Mary Poppins and they thought Abby would be perfect for the role. This was Kim Acuna, who played Mary Poppins. And again, Jenna Pacina Laird was the producer. And they agreed Abby would be perfect for the part. So we were off and running again for another stage performance.
My guest is Bob Magic, and he has a dog named Abby, who is a star of stage and their hearts. Yeah. How could you not love a dog like Abby? And his book is Abby's Tale. It's not Bob's first book. He's written other books on other topics. But this one, he tells us about this dog that they adopted, a rescue dog. And she overcame a lot of things before she got to the point where she could be in The Wizard of Oz, before she could be in Mary Poppins. And how did you resolve some of the things that she brought with her?
Well, that speaks to her problems in getting adopted. We rejected her twice. And when Susan Marshall fostered her, there was one parent looking for this friendly dog. They drove all the way up, I think at least 2 hours, maybe more, to check Gypsy out. And Gypsy was totally frightened of them, cowered behind Susan's legs, and the people just didn't think she was a friendly little dog. The fellow thought he was a dog person, yet this dog was avoiding him. So that was Gypsy's first refusal. We came next. And Susan brought Gypsy with a second dog, a buddy system. And the second dog was unbelievably cute and personable, looking much more like the kind of dog we imagine us having, a terrier-poodle kind of mix, just really playful and handsome, whereas Abby was withdrawn. And we didn't take to Abby's appearance. We thought her...
She looks so cute in her pictures.
Well, at that point, she was... Her hair was scraggly, her tail was thin, and Deanne referred to it as kind of ratty. So her physical appearance was not something we took to, and plus she was very shy and withdrawn. So we left thinking that we probably are not all that enthusiastic about Gypsy. But as I kept looking at a picture that I took of Abby, and you have it there in the book,
yes.
Of a
your smiling. Wife holding this little dog.
Right. And you could just see her captivated and enamored with this little animal. So I thought, well, let's give her a try. You know, this little appearance, a black dog, it's not a terrier, but, you know, it's intriguing enough. Let's maybe check her out further, especially given Deanne's affinity for her. So when she was on a snowshoeing trip, Deanne, I had Susan bring her over. And
you're going to surprise your wife when she got home.
Correct.
Welcome her with this cute little dog.
Yeah, as a trial visit. Well, Susan spent quite a bit of time going over paperwork and so on. But as soon as Susan left, I mean, Gypsy just cowered by the front door. And then she, when I went over to greet her and befriend her, she just ran, terrified, to our patio door. And then, you know, she would in no way warm up to being there with me. So even when Deanne got home, Gypsy's behavior continued along that same line, terrified, absolutely. And I made a very hasty conclusion that this could not be the friendly pet, you know, we wanted, because we visit people and we, you know, we take our dog with her. So that I just called Susan and said, you know, come and take her. And Susan, first reaction, as I recount in the book, it was, oh, the poor dog.
She didn't care about you.
No, exactly.
She said, oh, that poor dog.
Right. Which is, you know, shows her true values and her love for animals. So that Gypsy was sent away. But then, as recounted in that chapter that Susan penned, she...
Yeah, one of your chapters in your book is written by the woman who was the foster parent of, at the time, Gypsy.
Correct.
And so you have her give the thing, the situation, describe it from her point of view.
Correct. And there were additional trials that Gypsy failed. Whenever another dog was part of the scene, and many families, couples are looking for a companion dog in this particular case, and Gypsy failed those magnificently, and it leading Susan to conclude accurately that, okay, I get it. Gypsy needs to be the only dog in a household. I mean, that showed up three or four or five times as she was getting rejected. So that Susan started taking her to various places, in other words, socializing her, getting her used to humans. In some cases, she actually behaved well with other dogs. So then at that point, she said, oh, I wish the Magics could see her now, because she thought we were the perfect couple. We were looking for an athletic little dog, and it seemed like there was a good match there. So the third trial with us was a charm. I mean, she came, she was confident, she was bold, and the rest is history. You know, we accepted her, if not right on the spot, after Deanne went for a walk and they clicked.
My guest is Bob Magic, and he has written the story of his little dog, Ebby, Ebby's Tale, From Shelter to Stage. And from what you describe, she sounds like such a smart dog. But then in the chapter, one of your chapters, you list the top 10 dogs that are considered the smartest. And her breed, she's a mixed breed, but
right.
She didn't make the top 10. Bob.
That breed.
In fact, you say she's not the smartest dog. She seemed awfully smart to me. But
yes. And, you know, those 10 breeds are listed in the book, The Intelligence of Dogs, written by Stanley Coren, who, by the way, gave us a very, very nice blurb.
He did on the back.
On the back cover. But those intelligence factors that he lists are for one of the four kinds of dog intelligence. And mm-hmm. It's more the rote memory, the performance aspects, which Ebby stars in because she's so food motivated. She'll do anything. But there were other intelligence factors that that listing of dogs does not speak to.
Yeah, yeah. Well, when you're telling this story, and you and I are both dog lovers, and you feel that emotion in your heart. In fact, one day I was walking my little dogs in Mountain View, and this woman walked by and said, oh, heart melters. And I have remembered that phrase ever since, because I said, oh, that's absolutely right. Little dogs like that melt your heart.
Well, dogs just live to be a companion to a human being. That's all there is to it.
In fact, I want to give Ebby credit. I don't think I've mentioned before, but she was a therapy dog. She qualified for – actually, she was a canine good citizen. She was a therapy dog. She was a service dog, as well as a star of stage. So I think people, particularly dog lovers, are going to love your book and want to read about how did she qualify to be a therapy dog and a service dog. It's been such a pleasure talking to you, Bob, about Ebby.
Well, wonderful. Yeah, I enjoyed this book so much.
After a break, Orland author and retired math teacher Jane King has written the story of a fox in the family, about a fox she and her family raised when her sons were young. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest today has loved animals from the time she was young, especially dogs, cats, and horses. And then she has had a lifelong passion for fox hunting on horseback. Orland author and illustrator Jane King graduated from Purdue University and did her master's work at Chico State University. She taught math at Orland High School and Butte College and tried sketching portraits of her students, but found portraits of animals more fulfilling. Her master's project at Chico State was writing and illustrating a true story about raising a fox cub in Indiana, a story which she has now published as a book called A Fox and the Family. Jane King, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's delightful to be here.
Now, I am curious as to how you even learned to fox hunt on horseback.
When I was very small, I'm thinking 6 years old, maybe even younger than that, my godparents fox hunted in Indiana, and they had a great big French coach horse, and we first started riding on that, three of us all together, could fit on the back of this huge horse, and that got me started riding. And then when I was 8 years old, I went down to North Carolina to visit my godparents, and they were fox hunting, and I went to school down there, and they put me on a pony, and pretty soon I was out there chasing the hounds. It was just so exciting and invigorating.
Well, now, you say this was in Indiana, and since I live several years in Indiana myself, because my master's degree is from Indiana University, so I'm familiar with how beautiful that parts of it, like Brown County, so I was trying to imagine exactly where in Indiana you were living.
This would be north of Indianapolis in the Carmel mm-hmm. area, and their place was called Folly Farms because it was a lark.
So you only mentioned a couple of places, Indianapolis, of course, the capital, and then later on when you go to a zoo, you mentioned the name of it. But I kept wondering, well, where exactly is this? Because Indiana has beautiful countryside, and I just imagine what your farm must have been like when you were growing up.
Well, this was in Muncie, Indiana. We had 10 acres, and half of it was woods, and the other half was pasture. And we had three horses and a little pony that were there. And it was, you could just ride through the woods and make your own trails. It was wonderful.
Well, my husband happened to have been born in Muncie, and they had 5 acres. And I can't remember if he had a pony or a horse. I don't think he did. But so I'm happy to hear that I can actually visualize where this place is, that you have your animals and where you're growing up.
We even had a pony cart, and in the summertime, when we had a garden, we'd take our extra vegetables in the pony cart and go to the subdivision across the street and put them on everybody's doorstep.
My guest is Jane King, and she has written a book, A Fox in the Family. But, Jane, I hesitate to even say you merely wrote a book, because your illustrations are just wonderful. And I'm wondering, if you were a math major, because you've taught math, how did you get to be such a talented artist?
Well, I was first an artist, and then I got divorced and needed a job, and I'd always liked math, and so I already had my master's degree, but I went back to school and started from scratch with high school algebra and got my teacher's credential, and I went through 4 semesters of calculus and beyond in 3 years. So I always tell my college students, if there's a will, you know, you can do it.
Well, I think sometimes they're thinking, okay, I've got to make the decision that I'm going to be with the rest of my life. I'm going to be a history major. That's the rest of my life. So you started out in art and switched over to math.
Yes. Yes. And the two work beautifully together. It was just amazing because math is a lot of patterns. And I just love that part of it.
Well, describe for the listeners what is on the cover of your book, because this is an illustration you did.
Yes, it's a black and white ink drawing of the fox when she was mature. And she was very sly and crafty looking.
Sly as a fox. She lived up to her name.
Yes, definitely.
Well, since we've mentioned that this is a fox, of course, this is a book about a fox in your family. And then inside you have drawings, not just for the foxes, but the other animals in your family.
Yes. Originally, when I started doing the sketches and writing little notes, my children were 2 and 4. And I knew two boys. They would not remember if I didn't write something and take some pictures and do some sketches. So I started writing little excerpts and doing some sketches. And it, you know, just kind of grew and grew and grew. And now I ask my boys, who are both in their 40s, what do you remember about the little foxes? They go, not anything except what's in your book.
Aha, uh-huh. Yeah. So their memories would have faded altogether had you not made a record of
it. Yes, yes. And they look at the pictures and they can't believe it's them.
Well, now, when you say pictures, you include some photographs in your book, as well as your illustrations and pen and ink drawings. But the back cover of your book, for example, tell people what's on the back cover of your book.
Starts out with the foxes when they are very small, and then the fox when we originally released her. And then the bottom picture is of me with the two boys when we'd had the foxes about a month, I think, because they're really
fat. They're still
fat.
Very small.
Yes. They're really fat.
Them up. Mm-hmm.
Yes, they were much smaller than that. I would say they were 4 or 5 weeks old when we got them.
Well, I'm glad you included a picture of your sons at that age, because I can see from the photograph how accurate your sketches were, because you sketched your young sons at that age.
Yes.
And your sketches are very accurate. This is just what they look like in your sketches. And I also have to comment on your hairdo, because hairdos change. And tell us what year this was.
This was 1973 and 74. And at that time, the only time in my life I've had long hair. So the picture on the hardcover in the very back, I'm wearing my hair down, and on the front page, I have my hair up in a like a bun back then.
Well, since you mentioned the photographs, also in this photograph, you're holding one of these adorable foxes, but also in the picture are these equally adorable little canines.
Yes, at that time we had 3 Jack Russell Terriers. We had a Jack Russell Terrier little female that came from Ireland, and then we wanted to breed her, so we got a little male Jack Russell Terrier. And then we had a friend who went fox hunting in England, and she left her Jack Russell with us, and we didn't get that terrier until about, maybe 8 months after we had the foxes. So it was amazing how well the fox got along with all of them.
Yeah. Well, you know what surprises me is that your photographs are very accurate. And I could see how young boys might sit for a little while. They wouldn't be too willing to sit for a portrait. Your dog, I know Jack Russell Terriers, I don't think they would be too happy sitting for a portrait. But foxes, now, how did you go about sketching these various animals who would not say, oh, sure, Jane, we'll just sit here and pose for you?
Well, I went by pictures that I had and then just memory. Because the fox was so quick, like you say, they're so quick and agile that you just have to kind of freeze it in your mind and then do the sketch. And then you come back and look at the sketch and go, no, that's not quite right. And then you do another sketch that's a little bit better, and you keep refining it down until you have just what you want. But fortunately, I wish I had taken more photographs. I think I only took maybe 30 photographs in all. And I wish I'd had the time or the thought at the time when I was photographing to take just zillions of them, but I didn't.
Because you do have a lot of sketches and a lot of illustrations in your book, just about every page, which certainly enrich the experience, and they are so delightful, your illustrations are. Now, you mentioned that you have these other animals that are living there in your household.
Yes, we also had a cat.
And a cat. And people understand how you mentioned you got one little dog from Ireland, how you get dogs and cats and horses. But how do you get a fox? So when and where did you meet these foxes?
Well, we rescued them from an old barn, and they were going to tear down the barn with a bulldozer. And because our terrier had been in a newspaper article about our family because we fox hunted.
So this little terrier you got from Ireland was already known in the community.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And so this lumber dealer called us up and said, you know, bring your terrier over and see if she'll go to ground. And we had no idea if she would do that. But
so at least he was considerate. He realized that he didn't want to harm these little foxes.
Oh, yes.
That were there.
They were very, very careful. They did not want to do anything and that would hurt the foxes.
So they call you up and say, bring your dog and let's see if we can rescue these little foxes.
Unfortunately, when we went, we had to go after work, after my husband's work, so we didn't get out there until 5:30, and this is February. So it was, you know, very close to being dark. So our opportunities were very limited, and we did get two little foxes. But the next day when they bulldozed it down, the bulldozer man, he got a fox and saved another fox. But he treated his like a wild animal, mm-hmm. and we treated ours like cats because they used a litter pan when we put them in the cage.
You know, that's what people might not realize, that a fox will use a litter box.
Well, we were amazed, too, because just because they looked like kittens, we put the litter pan in the cage overnight when we first got them, and they used it. So they were in the house. They were house foxes from then on.
Well, let's give the listeners a chance, an opportunity to hear some of your writing. Let's start with the very first, A Fox in the Family, there, where you got a sketch there of where you were living at the time, I assume.
Oh, okay, yes. Thick woods surrounded our Indiana home, and the woodland creatures often found their way into our home. Our home was a sanctuary, convalescent hospital, and sadly, sometimes a burial ground for the local wildlife. Neighbors, friends, and would-be friends knew where to take orphan birds and stray cats. The tally of the animals in our household fluctuated with the seasons. Besides several horses, dogs, and cats, we often had quail, chukar, turtles, frogs, mice, and various small birds residing with us. My husband Jim and I had moved to the country after our first son was born, and by the time our second arrived, we knew where to find the great horned owl resting during the day, the crow's favorite caucus tree, the bee tree, shortcuts through the woods to the neighboring farms, the swampy areas with the most vicious and enormous mosquitoes, the old pasture with the smelliest mud from forgotten pig wallows, and lovely pink lady slippers just off the beaten path.
This is Jane King. She lives in Orland now, and she is a retired math teacher who has written a book about a fox being a member of her household. And she wrote and illustrated this book. So this is the setting of when you're living there out in your place in Indiana, your house that you moved out into the country, where you can have all these assortment of animals.
It was our driveway to our house was about a quarter of a mile long. And all along the driveway, that was pasture. And then behind our house was the woods into both sides, very deep woods. And we just had all sorts of critters that would come in from the woods. And, of course, our terriers would hunt any type of thing they could find. And so we had lots of unusual experiences with animals.
Well, why don't you read us a little bit of one of your terriers in action, if you, Jane?
Peering through the top half of the stable's Dutch door, Jim and I saw piles of old lumber, a dusty window with several broken panes, lots of cobwebs, and two well-used holes hidden beneath stacks of wood. Maggie sniffed the air and couldn't wait to get inside. As Jim and I opened the door to the crumbling stall, Maggie dashed in immediately, finding one hole. Everyone else quickly took up watch posts around the structure.
So we might remind people that this is the barn where these little foxes are.
Yes.
And Maggie has been called in as a star expert on...
Yes, we had no idea. But Maggie acted like an old pro, bolting down the hole to the tip of her tail before we realized what she was doing. In a few seconds, she had completely disappeared. Immediately, growls, barks, and whimpers emanated from the depths of the earth. Agonizing minutes went by as Jim and I kneeled over the hole, heads down, listening to labored grunts and groans. Still, no pups emerged from any of the piles of lumber, rubbish, or walls around the barn. And I might add, at this point, you wonder what you'd done to your terrier. I mean, you could lose your terrier down the hole and never... You know, and have to dig her out in the middle of the winter.
Because they are single-minded when they are on the trail.
Oh, yes.
I sometimes imagine going, because I had dachshunds. And they're
they're bred to do the
same thing.
And they
go absolutely deaf to your voice when they are on the trail of a squirrel or whatever it is they're tracking.
Well, actually, the more you yell down the hole, the more they think they have backup. And so when we finally had to get her out, we just left the hole. And so when she didn't have any backup, she finally came out. Like, where are my people?
The title of this book is A Fox in the Family. And so what did Maggie help flush out? You want to continue reading that?
Okay. Suddenly, a child's squeal from outside the barn announced that something had been glimpsed. Whatever it was quickly retreated into the depths of the crawl space under the barn. Seconds later, a creature scooted through the woods adjacent to the stable. The children had come prepared with a snare on a long pole, and to our amazement, captured a little fox, holding it on the ground with quivering hands until one of the adults could pick it up. No one knew the size, age, or disposition of the pup, so we were apprehensive about being bitten.
We might add that you said that the children had come prepared. These were not your children because yours were too young. They
yes.
had stayed home, and these were the children, the owner of the barn.
These were two twin boys that were the children of Mr. Barnes, and they were fantastic. I can't imagine how they snared the little foxes. They had to be really quick to snare it, and they did.
So, and then what about this little thing that they found? You describe it next.
Okay. It was about the size of a four-week-old kitten and didn't look ferocious to me, only scared. The fox pup was very docile when I picked it up and put it in my pocket. Quickly, it burrowed into the depths of the lining and snuggled up in a ball.
Well, now, Jane, you're saying here that this little looked like a kitten, and you say it just looked scared, it didn't look ferocious. But the fox pup was very docile when I picked it up and put it in my pocket. Now, that's a surprise.
Normally, like if you would try to pick up a feral kitten, they would be hissing and spitting and clawing. A real kitten. They would. The fox just, you know, just totally relaxed. I mean, it was just like you were picking up a puppy. It was just amazing. So when it didn't snarl about being held.
Because you'd think if it were scared, it would want to bite you.
Yes.
Out of fear.
And it just, we wondered how hungry they were because when we did get them home, they were ferocious eaters.
So that could have been a factor,
too. And it was just, it wanted to be in your pocket and curl up. It wanted to be safe. And so nobody had seen the mother for days. So we have no idea.
Well, that right away would endear that little creature to you, I'm sure.
Oh, yes. Yes, they were just so cute. It's just unexplainable. You have to see a baby fox. And I tried to take some pictures, but when we very first got them, I didn't take any pictures at all, and I wish I had. Mm-hmm. The one picture where they're really small that we're holding, I think that was taken a couple of weeks later when we had fattened them up, and it shows a nice little fat tummy on one of the foxes.
Well, you say you got a late start in the day to begin with, and so you said our flashlights were starting to dim. Why don't you read that section after you've just caught this little creature and put it in your pocket?
By now, our flashlights were dimming, and Maggie either wouldn't or couldn't come out of the hole. We began to worry that she was stuck and thought we might have to dig her out. About the time Jim arrived with a shovel, Maggie emerged, panting, filthy, odoriferous, and with her black eyes gleaming. A quick grab for her tail prevented her from submerging a second time while we reconnoitered the troops for another attempt at routing the pups. By now, dusk had passed. With feeble flashlights, we surveyed the rear of the decayed barn where one pup had been seen. There had to be more. I let Maggie go, and she eagerly disappeared down the burrow once again. Quickly, Jim and I joined the rest of the watchful crew behind the building, hoping more pups would be forced to come out of hiding. In a rare moment of silence, amid the muffled barks and snarls underground, a pair of beady black eyes and tiny pointed ears appeared under the weathered siding and instantly disappeared under the flooring.
My guest is Jane King. She lives in Orland and is a retired math teacher who has written this book. And, Jane, I'm wondering if when you're writing this book, I mean, I know originally it was kind of for yourself, I think.
Yes, it was.
To make a rich record and to include... put together, collect these sketches. But who do you envision as your audience when you publish this book?
Well, originally it was written for children, and I have gone to a second grade classroom. They had this book read to them. They absolutely adored it and invited me to come to the classroom. And I did, and I felt like I was not king for the day, but queen for the day. And they even drew little pictures of foxes, and they asked all sorts of questions. And the most wonderful part that I could not express in the book is the sound that the foxes made when they greeted our dogs or each other. And I will make it now. And believe me, the whole second grade class could make this sound without any problem. And I did that.
That's the sound of foxes.
That's the sound. When they're greeting, they would put their paws down and their rumps up in the air and scoot underneath the dogs or the cat. And that was their greeting. And of course, the dog, it just freaks the dog out. And so they didn't, you know, the dog snarled, but they didn't try to grab the foxes because they were doing that. And that was their greeting, including when they were older. They did that also when they met a strange dog. And it was so fun to hear a whole class of second graders do that.
Imitating a fox.
Yes, yes.
Because I don't know that I've ever heard a fox, but I would never guess that's what a fox sounded like. Well, but you say under particular circumstances.
Yes, and I don't know. I know that the fox did it when she was about close to a year old. She still made that sound. But I don't know, you know, I know they can bark and yip, that type of thing, as mature adults. But I don't know if it's like a juvenile noise, you know, just mm-hmm. puppies make and, you know, juvenile foxes make. But it's certainly a sound made in greeting, not a sound that they would just make ordinarily. They only do this when they greet each other and their mom.
Well, now, mom, because you didn't know about their biological mother.
Yes.
But when you say their mom, you mean?
Yeah, they would greet me that way sometimes.
Greet you,
too.
Yes, because you were their adopted mom.
Yes, and they hoped that every animal that came in was. You know, part of the family too. And that was what was fun, because when the fox was a year old and we had guest dogs, we wondered about how that was going to work.
Because and a guest dog might not realize this is a family member, might say, oh, there's a varmint that needs to be gotten rid of.
Definitely. And including our terrier, who we did not, Maggie, we did not let her see the foxes after we took them home. She could see them through the glass slider, but we didn't put her in the house for a couple of weeks until the foxes were pretty well acclimated. And she never tried to grab them or anything. She snarled, but that was it. But the guest dogs didn't even do that. They ran.
Well, might remind people that the title of your book is A Fox in the Family. And you just said that when you went out to this old barn, you captured two little foxes.
Yes.
So how did you go from having two to one?
Well, everybody kept saying, well, you have those foxes. That's pretty dangerous. You know, they could have rabies and on. So I thought, all right, I'll take them to the vet and see what the vet says. So we put them in this little carrier, this little Irish molded wood carrier that we'd had when we got our terrier, and we took them to the vet. And all you could see of the foxes was the screen in the front. And all the other dogs in the veterinarian's office, in the waiting room, what was that smell? They were just so curious. And so we had them. I asked the vet, what should they have? And he said, well, they're too young to have the rabies shot, but I'll give them the distemper shot. And so he gave them each one the distemper shot. And the terrier, the puppy, got his shots too. And the foxes were very stoic. They got their shots. They didn't do a thing. But the terrier, he tried to bite the vet. So it was pretty funny. But one of the foxes, we think, got distemper from the distemper shot. The vet thought it was a bad shot. And it was the fox bit me because it was in such agony. And so since it had bitten me, I had to take the brain to Indianapolis to be...
Well, you had to take it to the vet
biopsy.
So that they could send
mm-hmm. it. Mm-hmm. Yes, I took it to the vet, and then he packaged the brain all up so I didn't have to look at it.
Yeah.
And I drove it to Indianapolis, and they couldn't find anything wrong with it at all.
Mm-hmm.
They said it definitely wasn't rabies, but whether that was distemper or not, they couldn't tell.
And you couldn't take a chance since it had bitten you.
You couldn't take a chance because I had been bitten, yes. Yeah. So we just had one, and she just became the gourmet fox of the household and spoiled beyond any belief.
Well, now you say she, and when you first got these two little cubs, you had to figure out, well, what gender are they? What kind of name should we give them? Well, you named them Frisky and Friendly, so worked out. That could be either.
But originally, I thought they were males. And they were so tiny, and so my husband just totally thought that was hilarious because he'd made a mistake on a kitten before, so he wasn't going to say. And I just, you know, looked, kind of, they were just so fuzzy. I thought, well, I think they're male. And until later, till she came in season, we had no idea that it was a she instead of a he.
So you were surprised to
learn.
Well,
yes.
Well, there was a lot you didn't know about foxes
because
you were learning as you went along.
Yes, I did know quite a bit because I'd read a lot of them since a lot of the fox hunting stories I read when I was little, and it talked a lot about foxes and their habits and everything. And I do want to say that when you fox hunt on horseback, you do not really want to kill the fox because then you have nothing to chase and have fun later on. So most people who fox hunt are great conservators mm-hmm. of a fox's habitat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you have this little animal, this wild animal, living with you, but yet he seems to be much more of a pet than other wild animals. I've heard of families taking in other wild animals, and they just don't go against their nature. This little fox seemed like he just liked being with you.
Oh, she was incredible. She loved to play. She was the gourmet fox. She only liked barbecued chicken, not raw chicken, because we tried them both. And broccoli, if it had hollandaise sauce, but not unless it had hollandaise sauce. And she did like to get in lobster shells. And but every time you opened the refrigerator, she would appear. And the two-year-old was her favorite because he was always carrying around a box of raisins. And there's a photograph of her, of him feeding her raisins. And he couldn't even remember what it was that he was feeding. He goes, "What did I have in my hand?" I said, "That little red box of raisins, that's what she wanted."
Well, that's another nice thing about writing this story, because then your sons, they were too young. I mean, 2 and 4,
yes.
Too young really to remember. So now they have this record. And you said this sentence in your book, that animals age gracefully and accept their infirmities. Because there are times when he had a problem with his leg and
yes,
he had to take him to the doctor.
Yes, it's just amazing.
But you say that animals age gracefully and accept their infirmities. Now, you've said that one reason you are retired is that you had some health problems yourself.
Yes, I've gone through a breast cancer and heart problems, AFib. So it was quite a challenge to have it all in 1 year. And so it's just wonderful to recover and be healthy again. And
do you think maybe animals then inspire you to be more graceful?
Oh, yes.
In accepting your infirmities?
Oh, yes, because an animal, any of the dogs and cats that we've had, and I've had both with eye problems, they put stuff in their eye or their eye is really hurt and whatever, and they just accept that they can't see out of that eye, and, you know, they just go on with their life, and they're just as happy as they were before, and you're just kind of amazed that they can just suck it up like that. Instead of cowboying up, it's animal up.
Yeah. I mean,
they're wonderful.
So there are so many lessons that can be learned from this animal.
Yes.
And so I'm so glad you wrote this story for us to enjoy. So it's a good children's book where adults can be inspired by this and enjoy the beautiful illustrations in your book. And I'm sure your family appreciates this record of that time in their life.
Yes, very much so.
It's been such a pleasure talking to you, Jean.
Wonderful to be here.
I would also like to thank my first guest, Anderson author Bob Magic, for telling us about his latest book, Ebby's Tale, From Shelter to Stage. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.